My name is Bill Daley. This is the second in the series of three discussions with President Richard Bjork, which is a contribution toward an oral history of the college. He has been president of the college since its inception in 1969, and on the eve of his departure for another post. Dick, I thought we might talk today about the process of putting the raw materials together in such a way as to build a college, and about, in general, the topic of governance. And I thought we might talk, first of all, about the pressures on the colleges, on the college, or the constraints on the college from outside the college. I was wondering if there was a particular character to New Jersey politics that impinged decisively on the college in the early days and continues to impinge on it in terms of attitudes of the people toward education and funding and their reflection in the minds of their elected representatives.
Yeah. Well, I think there was originally, given the powers I mentioned in the first interview of the then-Senator Hap Farley, there was concern that his power was so substantial in this part of the state, and there was concern that his influence had been so strong in getting a college to be located and built in this part of the state, that there would be the prospect of substantial political involvement and maybe even interference in the development of the college, particularly in such areas that are sensitive, such as staffing, because political processes generally include trying to find appropriate rewards, namely jobs, for people who have helped in that process. So there were some apprehensions, I think, by anyone involved with starting the college and some of the people early on. In terms of the direct political process, elected officials and people such as that, we have had from the inception no significant even contact with them that would be associated with, will you do something for me or will you do something a particular way. The most pressure we ever get and continue to get are such things as, will you speak to someone who is interested in a position in your institution? And we always do speak with them. It isn't very often we hire those individuals, but that seems to be enough. There are occasionally pressures, if you like to call it that, will you please admit a student? In all instances that I can recall, we would have admitted the student anyway, since this is a relatively open access institution. The most current political favoritism question is, can my son, daughter, friend, or whoever get into housing, on campus housing? But those are all, I think, the ordinary political pressures that come from elected public officials. No one has interfered in trying to evaluate personnel here, to try to say so-and-so should or should not be retained. I think in the early days when we had quite dramatic personnel activities and very colorful demonstrations by students and faculty about a number of issues, I was really quite surprised that there weren't telephone calls or letters or visits that would indicate that the political system would like to have these things handled in a particular way. So the formal political apparatus of that sort has not impinged on the college. I have found, in fact, that the politicians, whether they be governors or assembly or senator, the kind of elected politicians, have been supportive and helpful. We can go to them and ask for various kinds of support, and we've gotten everything from roadways to signs to sometimes a little extra nudge in the budget process from the elected political personnel without any favors in return. And as some people will know from the written record and the like, I've had my differences with governors and have taken strong stands that are not supportive of the point of view of the governor, and particularly in some elements of dealing with union negotiations and the strike and things of that nature, where the governor and I have not agreed. That has never, in my, to my knowledge, resulted in our being in any way punished or disciplined or falling from favor, and I have not found that to be a difficulty at all. The organized bureaucracy, if you like, the so-called civil servant, the person who is responsible for sort of managing the processes that implement policies of the legislature and the executive, We have had, I think, extraordinary cooperation from those that I'll speak of that are primarily in the budget facility support processes, leaving education aside for the moment. And those groups have responded to what they consider good management of this college by facilitating all of that, you know, paperwork that goes with a public sector organization, and that we have had really, I think, reasonable support out of the official support bureaucracy of the state. Certainly we get frustrated with some of the rules and regulations. Certainly we get frustrated with the time that it takes to get certain things done. But if the college itself is organized, as I think it is, it can get through those processes with relatively little difficulty. And if the institution plans, gives lead time, we can get things done in a timely manner. And our orientation has been strongly in that direction. And particularly our administration and finance area of the college has worked hard to find cooperative, supportive working relationships with the budget and with the financial and personnel and construction people. By and large, those have gone well. The people who are in the formal higher education bureaucracy, the Chancellor of Board of Higher Education and their staffs, we have had our share of stunning disagreements with them and running battles about the development of higher education, the support for Stockton. All of these, if you like, battles have always been very much up front, out in the open. We make our positions clear, try to argue them as aggressively and effectively as possible. And despite people on the Board of Higher Education who have questioned the more non-traditional nature of Stockton, who wonder if we're doing good things or if we're just pursuing fads, chancellors who have, by their own interests, been skeptical of experimentation in higher education, to staff personnel in the Department of Higher Education who have vacillated between service and control from a central point. The scorecard on that, I think, is still quite good from the institution's point of view. I argued at the outset, when I was the Vice Chancellor of Higher Education for the state, that the two new colleges should not be called state colleges, that they should be written into public higher education in some way that was different from the other state colleges to avoid state agency status. One of my suggestions was that it be incorporated into the university system and that we become colleges of the university system, and that the other was that they be given a distinctive status as colleges of arts and sciences, let's say. And in both instances, these ideas did not fly. The former about the university, I think, largely because the then president Gross of Rutgers and Chancellor Dungan saw eye to eye on virtually nothing, and that the prospect of adding two new institutions to the university did not appeal to the chancellor. He, I think, wanted to help influence the development of these institutions and thought that could be better be done outside of the university's framework. The idea that they should be given some special in-between status between the existing state college and universities did not create quite as much interest, and as a consequence, I think the processes just went forward and they let it become a situation where the Ramapo and Stockton became state colleges without ever dealing with that issue squarely. And I think also the Chancellor Dungan at that time was interested in having some strong influence in the general direction of these two new colleges, because, as you may recall, he was very critical of the other six state colleges and their what he considered rather pedestrian programs and failure to develop rapidly. But I must say, even though he had that interest, Chancellor Dungan, he was, I think, a combination of preoccupied with all kinds of other issues, and he was also not well known for his follow-up on things. And we were, despite his interest, permitted to go our way. And the Board of Trustees and the small initial staff really, in an unfettered way, did design the college. and it has developed almost without significant pressure interference from external agencies. As I said in the other interview, the changes that have come to the college are really generated internally. We're doing it ourselves. Now, I think the prospects for increased commonality among the institutions, that those prospects are also increasing. The combination of declining financial resources and a new chancellor, Hollander, who appears to have more of an orientation toward coordination and control and accountability than toward using the Department of Higher Education as a service support prodding agency for the colleges, that the prospects are increasing from these two elements for at least more formal bureaucratic, if you like, involvement. And now as we're talking, you know, just a few weeks ago, Governor Byrne intervened dramatically in the internal affairs, most people would say, of one of the colleges, namely Edison, when by a combination of financial pressure and declination on the appointment of trustees produced the, if you like, termination of the services of the president. And that had been unheard of since 1968 when the Department of Higher Education came. So those who are looking for signs on the horizon, there probably are some that would suggest increased involvement from external forces, combination of elected political officials and the bureaucracy responsible.
Is the content of that kind of constraint, Dick, simply to be likely to be in the form of the convenience of bureaucratic convenience of more commonality, or do the people who are likely to intervene have a philosophy that they're likely to impose? Is it simply convenience, or is it some disapproval of non-traditional things, something with more substance than convenience?
I think it's primarily convenience, as you, to use your word, control, coordination. There is, I think, a problem with the bureaucracies as they develop. They have to increasingly find ways of persuading authorities of various sorts, executive and legislative, as well as the public, that they are doing their business. And every time they get a question or a challenge to higher education, they have a choice to make between sort of interpreting the institutions and their programs to these various publics and critics, or responding by saying, we'll look into that, we'll take care of that, we'll settle that. And there is, I think, an increased interest both on the part of the critic and the bureaucracy that handles the criticism to deal with the criticism. And as a consequence, they want to be able to deal with institutions that are more alike than unlike, who have practices that are similar and not dissimilar. And you take critical things such as collective negotiations for all the eight state colleges, or add that to all the standard budget procedures and such, and you have an enormous force for commonality, for convenience, as you call it. Only occasionally have I encountered an individual or individuals within the bureaucracy who have a particular educational philosophy that they are trying to use as a vehicle for evaluation of us or imposition. It does happen. We have had some people in planning and research, in particular in the Department of Higher Education, who have ideas about arts and sciences that are perhaps more traditional than ours. We have had some people in the professional areas of the Department of Higher Education, primarily health, who have had particular ideas about how health programs should be run. But when, as they are fond of saying, push comes to shove, if we have a good argument and stick by it, most bureaucracies, when they run out of dealing with you by not answering or just asking another question, they give in to consistent pressure.
What are the weapons on both sides when push comes to shove? In other words, what can the central bureaucracy do to work its will, and what can a college like Stockton do to resist that pressure?
Well, if the central bureaucracy trotted out the statute and said, look, the statute has all these words about control and direction and approval and disapproval and this sort of thing, and they can marshal the Attorney General behind them because the Attorney General views the Chancellor and the Board of Higher Education as their primary clients. We're only secondary clients, and we have access to no other legal support. And the Attorney General makes it clear that in those instances of statutory interpretation, we better be prepared as a college to have the interpretations generally favor the center as well, instead of the peripheral unit. So they're on a very, very strong legal base. It is only, I think, lay control through boards of higher education combined with institutional representation on that same board that tendencies to assert the letter of the law are checked. I think the chancellor, and not just this chancellor, but a chancellor, unfettered by a lay and representative board, would have a much stronger inclination to go ahead and say, you shall do this, or you can't do that, and I order you to do this. And then the other countervailing force is obviously the local board of trustees idea, which is somewhat of a peculiarity in New Jersey. It's not common, at least, to have lay control and influence layered in between the chief executive for the state and a state board. And the current chief executive is not fond of the local boards at all, because they do impose an impediment to absolute, you know, central control. And they do have to be dealt with. They have to be dealt with politically. They are politically influential, and that was the idea. And not necessarily political simply in the political processes you know them formally, but in the public. And if you take the 9 persons from the 8 state colleges, there's 72 prominent people in this state, and no one simply ignores 72 prominent people in the state. They may try to get around them, they may try to do that. The other thing that we do, I think, to deal with the tendencies, let's say, for central control is, and when push comes to shove, when they want to challenge us a bit, is that I do think we marshal effective arguments. I do think we go through every step in the process carefully. I do think we are absolutely consistent and unrelentless in our pressure upon the central authorities. I do think we avoid 9 times out of 10 any opportunity for them to come back and say you did it wrong, that's not correct, and use all of those techniques that combine delaying, aggravation, and hope you will drop off of your pressure. And they have learned that in dealing with Stockton, that if we believe in what it is we're pursuing, that we will go after that in the most effective ways possible. The other thing is, we don't take to the streets, by and large, in our dealing with the bureaucracies. We're going to fight them on their own turf and with their own mechanisms. I do think it's generally a mistake to go to the press, to go to external bodies. You may win a momentary victory, as you know, but the residue of resentment from that victory is very, very substantial. But we have gone as far as to challenge the chancellor and the department in their recommendations to the Board of Higher Education, in this instance with respect to our having a public health degree program, when it had been denied by the chancellor, it had been denied by the staff, it had been an adverse recommendation of the Board of Higher Education, and we went back to the chancellor, went back to everyone and fought, and then I said, I would like to go to the Board of Higher Education. And I went and advanced our argument, and the chancellor and staff were overruled. Now, that's very risky business, but I must say...
Is it very infrequent, or is it...
It's almost, never happens,
I think.
And that's why it has to be done very carefully. And I think the only reason that the fallout was not so adverse from that was the fact that the chancellor had to admit that, we had done everything by the book, we'd exhausted every reasonable channel, and that we had a right to challenge it. He didn't like to lose because it was Chancellor Dungan at that time, and he's from the Kennedy stripe, and that group doesn't like to lose. But I must say, in their loss or defeat, they said, you fought a very good battle, much better than we did. And I think even your adversary admires a good battle.
Do you anticipate, looking to the future, Dick, that we're, that there is going to be more criticism of local autonomy in this sort of on-again, off-again conflict? Where do you think it's going in the long run? Do you think we're going to gradually have more commonality imposed on us, or do you think the colleges are going to be able to hold their own?
I think there will be much more commonality, and one of the reasons I have to report this, unfortunately, that is when someone digs this out of the archives, they'll have a comment or two, and that is, I think, by and large, the presidents of the state colleges are not willing to fight the battle systematically, effectively. They can easily be dissuaded from their initial reaction, which is, let's challenge this intrusion, let's challenge this effort. Mm-hmm. But I have watched them for the 9 years I've been operating in this environment, back off every single time when it comes to the point that the chancellor or the department or the board of higher education will say, come on, you folks, back off. They can be cajoled. They can be persuaded to take something else instead. They can be easily divided. And so as a divided community, they're not potent. And if you look at the record of the Council of State Colleges, which is the collected body of these people, the chairpersons and the presidents of the state colleges, you'll see over and over again the 7-1 votes. And Stockton, long history of dissent from this group. And most recently, 6-8 months ago, they got their backs up in reaction to what was called a loyalty oath the chancellor wanted all the presidents to sign, saying that his plans and his goals were those to which they subscribed. And please sign at the bottom of this memorandum, tear the bottom off, and send it. I mean, that is literally how it came. And so there was this great cry of outrage of this thing. And so the Council of State Colleges had kind of a special meeting, and they drafted, I thought, an excellent statement. Committee drafted an excellent statement of the chancellor's sort of error in this. He got very excited and met with them. Oh, they were going to go through with this and the like. Each board of trustees was to pass this resolution, and they were to do it by a certain time. Well, only Stockton's board passed the resolution, and they did it with the chancellor in the audience to his face, told him right there in public, that was the day he was on campus. Everyone else backed off and left us once again alone, but still, I think, true to our position. And without trying to sound, in any way kind of heroic, I think our Board of Trustees has the best understanding of why it is important that they attempt to resist the efforts of the Chancellor and the Department of Higher Education to deal with the colleges as though the president's report to the chancellor is an illustration that it's a straight hierarchical arrangement. And they are, as we know now, in the business of asserting one of their most important statutory rights, and that is the selection of the president. But we do know the chancellor is very interested in standing on the edges and has suggested that he might be of help. The board has indicated to the chancellor that when they seek his help, which would be at the very end of the process when finalists are around and should talk to the chancellor, that will be sufficient. And that they are, I think, concerned about the board's limited prerogatives even being eroded. We have just won another battle, and that is we challenged the chancellor on whether or not we had to send to the Board of Higher Education and to him for approval the establishment of the Center for Environmental Research as a unit of the college. And we got all kinds of chapters and verses of statute quoted to us, and we said that is not the language we read. We acknowledge that it should be reported to you. You should be fully informed, and it is in our budget message, and which you fully reviewed and approved. And they're like, that's sufficient. You had your chance at the budget point to challenge us on this. And that went through months and months of gnashing of teeth and yelling and screaming. And once again, the Council of State Colleges sort of folded on the issue. But within the last week, we did get a new proposed policy by the Chancellor, which gives us our point, and that we only have to report and we don't have to seek approval. So it can be done, but you have to be determined. Bureaucracy's powers generally derive from their ability to wear you down. And so if you don't have high-energy people who organize their thoughts well and advance their arguments systematically and consistently, to answer your question, the center will win. They have an enormous array of weapons, if you like, to do that. And they have time to do that. And I think we have, by good management here, by having something worthwhile that people want, and constantly arguing for it, and never letting anything slip by. You know, that's the other little trick. Sometimes things just sort of slip by, or there are half cakes offered, or half loaves offered, when you should really go after them, the full thing. Now, we've lost some, obviously. We don't always win. It's always nice, but not very helpful, to have the Department of Higher Education and Chancellor and the Office of Employee Relations say, oh, Stockton was absolutely right in collective negotiations on the librarian issue, that is, on faculty rank. But we were voted down 7-1. But now everyone thinks we had the right position. Or on the new, what's called A328 guidelines about career development. And we opposed all of those amendments to the agreement because they did a lot of things, including eroding local authority and such. And everyone said, thank you, that's an interesting argument, you did a beautiful job. But they signed them in secret anyway, and now we've just gone through an arbitration hearing, which suggests that they'll rue the day they ever signed that agreement. So you kind of, I guess in a small way, win the battle afterwards, but the thing is lost along the way. It's an inattentive system. It's not, you know, really very good at picking up what each little decision finally adds up to. And where I think we have succeeded in being competitive with the system and as a result often effective is that we, I think, are pretty good at figuring out what every little step ultimately will cost, where it is all leading, and to warn people to stop before they get there.
What about the local community, Dick? To what degree has the college been, in fact, constrained by the views of the immediate surrounding geographic area?
Well, I think the constraint imposed by your local community is primarily a function of how much you say to yourself that we want to get along, that we want to serve, want to be part of this community. Now, if you want to be an island, you can thumb your nose and say, I don't care what it is they think. And you can go a long way on that point of view, as many institutions have. You have all kinds of peripheral troubles that are generally associated with housing and police and things of that nature. But you still can get away with it to a large extent and just have a kind of local hostility. I think most of the people at Stockton assumed they wanted to get along with the local community. Therefore, they started with an attitude that, let us find out what their interests are, what they are like. Let us try to tell them what we are like and what it is we want to do. So that, I think, right off, people began to say, as I certainly did, you know, we are the new people on the block. We are the intruders into your lives, and that we have to hear, see, whatever your lives are about, and make adjustments to it. And I think a lot of people here have done extremely well at that. As you know, they've been on school boards, they're on planning boards, they run for office, they're highly dispersed, which is a comment and sometimes criticism people have made about the college. They're highly dispersed throughout the area, active participants in their community, and lots of things are done officially and formally to try to involve the community. Lots of time is spent in trying to work with people, whether it be in organizations or public arrangements and the like. So that I think there has been a considerable concern about our impact on the community, and that to that extent they've influenced our behavior. But it's not direct. The most significant thing that happens in that order in the community, obviously, is what the media does to the college and the community. And as I said to the media a few weeks ago, I'm fully aware that whatever they're going to report about the college in any prominent way is going to be something out of the ordinary, either good or bad. It wasn't just bad, but they're not going to... The media is a very poor vehicle to describe the college in its entirety accurately to anybody, because they're always dealing on the super something or other, the super goof or the super achievement. And that isn't the college. That's only part of it. So that's a very, as I say, very poor vehicle to try to get to the community. Unfortunately, it is a very powerful vehicle in terms of people's attitudes. And that's what you deal with mostly in the community, is responding to, you know, nude saunas, strikes, things of this nature that people think are bizarre. And that, unfortunately, takes a lot of time. But I don't believe that most people in this general region that we call the community still perceive Stockton as they did at the outset, as some kind of intruder, some kind of place where a lot of funny people were collected, both students, faculty, and staff. And now it's obvious more of their families are coming here. That says something in itself. Mm-hmm. And as more of them come here, the better the word is spread. I believe those are the people who spread the word most effectively, those who come here as students, those who are employees of the place, and they do it by talking one-on-one kind of business. So the community has not intervened, in my opinion, in any direct way. They've asked for services, and we've tried very often to provide them. We did some stupid things in trying to provide services that we shouldn't, such as you may remember long, long ago, services of a sort of Spanish-speaking development nature to people in certain social work programs of Atlantic City that we, in our early days, we were ill-equipped to touch. We've learned, I think, that the Atlantic Community College has a particular role in the community, that they can do much better than we, and that there are other things that we should do. So the community has not said shape it this way in any significant form at all. I think they've been supportive. I find them, on a personal level, very supportive. And I often chide my critics, particularly those who are in the union. I said, you help me a great deal every time you take to the media with criticisms about me and demands that I be fired. So that's the best support that I can get from anybody, because the reaction is overwhelmingly, keep it up, don't give in sort of business. And I think in recent years, that sort of criticism and taking to the media has been very moderated by the union in particular.
A more general kind of constraint, and a very general question. To what degree over the development of the college, and to your way of looking at it, has the college been shaped by the nature of the clientele that arrives at the gate? I've heard two different views of what colleges can and should be. One is that they respond in the same way that a business should respond to the consumer demand, and that the development of the college, in some sense, has to be highly responsive to what the student as consumer wants. And the other is that the colleges are in the business of not reflecting the students, but of transforming them, and that we ought not to be. What's your sense over the development of over the past several years in Stockton, of the degree to which the college has been and should have been shaped by the nature of the students that arrive at the door?
Well, we very early kind of addressed that issue in a rather direct way in looking at alternatives for the college with respect to program and location, trying to lay all the alternatives I could think of on the table to the Board of Trustees and the limited staff. One of the alternatives proposed was to, instead of building a set of buildings on our own property and the like, was to rent commercial space. And we looked at Prudential's big building in Linwood, and we looked at Shore Mall in those days, and said, why don't we go to commercial space where there are already restaurants, stores, parking, and keep our business strictly on the instructional side of the house, or very heavily on that, and rent open space, and if things come up and down, and like really go the consumer route, be the supermarket, as it was taught, and be very responsive to what the marketplace had for the moment. And, you know, even distinguished institutions have done that. Let's take Antioch College, you know, has dramatically changed its approach to be very consumer responsive. So we toyed with it, but it was a very brief, you know, encounter, so to speak. There was no serious interest in that. So we made a decision in terms of, in a physical sense, that begins to help answer the question.
Could you take just a minute and explain why that alternative was rejected? In other words, what were the major obstacles to that? Was it just too unorthodox, or were there substantive problems?
It was too unorthodox, I think. We didn't get to the really substantive problems. It was really considered out front as too unorthodox. Got to remember, the Board of Trustees of this college, the original Board of Trustees, using any kind of quasi-psychological analysis that people love to do about boards and Supreme Courts and other things about how people behave, by anyone's reckoning, that is a very, the original board was a very conservative Board of Trustees, steeped in traditional education. And so the surprise to the world is that board was expected to develop a college that would be very traditional. But instead, as you know, they've developed a college that's the least traditional of all those in the state. And they couldn't, I think, go quite so far, get so far away from their own roots. Everyone's fond of roots these days. Get so far away from their own roots as to really see themselves in a kind of commercial environment. That was just too big a leap. But instead, you know, they made a leap that is reflected in the fact that they anticipated that they would have a mixed campus environment with a commuting environment. I mean, the combination of a limited amount of housing and an enormous amount of parking lots, you know, begins to respond to the question.
Right.
They expected both kinds of people. The fact that they spoke strongly and continue to about the balance between the professional and the arts and sciences tends to answer some of that question, too. Because the professional studies people tend to be the more consumer type than the others. And so they knew from the beginning they were going to try to walk a line between those. One thing that we did get out of the supermarket consumer concept, yeah, that we did, it wasn't so bizarre, that I was successful in finding an architect with the help of the board and persuading that architect that we should build a very, very flexible, inexpensive kind of space that so that the walls would not be such a strong influence on what we did as they are in many institutions. It's, if they're 6 feet thick and the like, you have a different attitude about changing things. So it's was intended to be another way of saying, look, we expect society to be more consumer-oriented. We remember used to use the term, we were trying to anticipate, and this is called, in my jargon, an anticipatory institution. And so it was set up physically to say, look, we know those pressures are going to come that say, I am the student, I am the consumer, I have so many choices, and I'm going to exercise them, and you're going to be responsive to my demands in that sense, my consumer demands. And our curriculum originally was an effort to be very responsive to the student interests, the student demand. We opened the doors fairly widely to student input, if you like, in the development of the curriculum. We gave it, and I argued, a minimal structure and brought together faculty, students, staff who developed a curriculum. And I've been critical of some of them for doing it slowly. I've been critical of some of them for not developing degree programs that I would consider rigorous enough. And we've been through years and years of trying to decide what general education should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we do still have a considerable mixture of the consumer orientation plus this is what a college student ought to have, and we're going to, if you use your words, try to transform them or change them somehow because of that experience. I think increasingly there will be an emphasis on repeating what we have been doing because as individuals stay around longer, they'd like to repeat some of the things they've been doing.
Sure.
And the more repetition you have of what you've been doing, the more the question gets answered in terms of we want to transform you, than in terms that say, we'll be responsive to what you're saying. And so it's been a very tight rope between saying, look, all of you people who want Psychology 101 can't have it at this time. All of you people who want accounting can't have it. And we've run some risks of disaffecting students as a consequence of limiting their choices by that mechanism and saying it's just not available. We're not going to let you into it. And hopeful that after they run up against some of this, they'll shape their thinking and distribute themselves better. We've toyed with but never concluded that we would have to have admission to degree programs as a way of controlling this. I think we're a little more at the threshold of people who have strong commitments to the arts and sciences, understanding that they don't have any arts and science programs if they don't have professional programs, that this is a relationship that cannot be avoided no matter what they might think about it intellectually or philosophically. There is no way of denying that professional studies bring such a large proportion of the student body to this place that they must be here, and that consumerism, as it's called, and transformation, as you're calling, are going to have to be very close partners. Now, I think this institution has done a great deal also in its non-instructional, non-academic areas to insist that the students change. I mean, here, I don't know how you describe the non-instructional program in terms of transformation consumerism. It is a very, very specific effort to change people's behavior. I mean, that effort to say you're going to have to learn how to do these things and here we'll teach you to do these things yourself, that is a very specific, highly controversial effort of the college not to be, if you like, as responsive to I want this or take care of me on that kind of business. And you've heard the fireworks around that for years and years. But in the instructional program, it is a combination, obviously, with, I think, a strong understanding of the fact that consumerism is important. It does bring people here. The buildings are designed to try to be responsive to that. The low tenuring is designed to be responsive to that. On the other side of it, the freedom of faculty to invent courses and curricula, that's responsive to them. So it's all sort of, you can't pick and choose just those things out of it you want. You got to get the whole package together to make it happen. And there are certain pieces of the package people don't like.
What do you see coming in terms of what the consumer is likely to demand? We've talked at least in a couple of areas that I'd be interested in hearing from you on in terms of arts and sciences versus professionalism in the future, and in terms of the degree to which the college will be able to maintain its attitude in co-curricular matters, that now you're an adult and you have to make some of these decisions yourself. And do you think the future bodes well for maintaining the balance in the curricular half and for asking students to manage their own affairs, or do you think we're going to lose those?
I think the pressure will be much more on the arts and sciences to be responsive, and that I don't think we should go back to that period where we just invented courses willy-nilly that combined someone's individual interest with whoever walked in the door, because I think the only countervailing force over unbridled consumerism that I really see of significance is that people are finding that all those things they choose didn't add up to anything that they really wanted in terms of career, profession, work. Mm-hmm. It didn't go anywhere. I think there is a realization that left completely to your own devices to put together an educational package, most people didn't do very well. In fact, they came out looking rather stupid in the process. They had a collection.